The Asian Classics Institute presents What the Buddha Really Meant with Geshe Michael Roach. Recorded live in New York City in November of 1998. This is the beginning of Class 11.
We had a goal of that disco party that was a complete flop last Friday. I told Thelma, you can't get these people to dance, and she said, yes, I can, and she didn't. But anyway, the goal was to raise $600 to repaint the children's school. And we had that by the beginning of class on Friday, and then about halfway through class, we had enough to throw in an electrical generator for Ghetto House, which they asked us for. And then by the end of the night, we had enough to... they asked us to sponsor a project to bring... sponsor an expedition to Tibet to expedite people's escape from Tibet. And we were able to pay for that also. So thank you for that. So that was a joke, what she put on... And she called it the disco bummer. But as a fundraiser, they asked us for three things last time we went, and just automatically we covered all three. To the dollar or something like that. It was really weird. So thanks for that. Tonight is a review class. I think you should all try to take the final. I won't tell you how many people took the Lojong final. I mean, how many person took the Lojong final. please take it, okay? I mean, come on, this is easy, all right? I mean, it's a question of whether you get a 99 or a 98, you know, come on. It's not to test what you don't know, it's just to remind you what you do know, okay? I mean, I don't care. I'm not trying to trick you. I'm actually going to give you all the questions right now, okay? And I just want you to... This is the stuff that Geshe still remembers 2 years later. Okay, so this is the stuff you really should remember. Okay, and this is the stuff you should carry with you for the rest of your life. You see what I mean? And that kind of stuff you should be able to answer for the rest of the time. Okay, so I really want you to be able to remember these things. Okay. Most difficult question, you know, what book did you study for Tange? Okay, Tange meaning. Things that the Buddha said that you have to interpret, and nye meaning things that the Buddha said that you don't have to interpret, figurative and literal. Okay, they say something like interpretive. I've never seen that word anywhere else. I think it's a dumb word. It's literal and figurative, okay? Something like that. And the book is called, in English, The Essence of Eloquence, on the Art of Interpretation. If you're going to do the Tibetan track, it's Tange Lekshe Nyingbo, okay? Tange Lekshe Nyingbo. And it was written by Jeto Kapa, okay? And you have to give his date, 1357 to 1419, okay? This is that famous embarrassing question. You meet the Dalai Lama's teacher and he asks you, what are you studying? And your teacher is standing next to him and trying to tell you, and this happened to me. Okay. Secondly, the question says, nowadays some people say that the knowledge of emptiness is not the main point of Buddhism. And others say that emptiness is something you only know intuitively and not from a foundation of determined, organized study. Describe a quotation by Lord Buddha himself that disproves these ideas. And then it's a sutra requested by Rashtrapala, okay? And it says, quote, beings must wander here in the realm of death and suffering because they have no knowledge of the ways of emptiness. And those who have compassion, meaning the Buddhas, and these are all quotations, right? Use skillful means and millions of different reasonings to bring them to it. So there's this debate in the monastery. Is it 1 million or 2 million or countless arguments that the Buddha said you have to study before you can understand emptiness? You see what I mean? Rigpa Tayeba means, you know, a limitless number of arguments. And then there's a debate in the monastery. Is that 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, you know? But the point is you have to study a lot. And that all the scriptures say the same thing. Tujungi Sherab, Samjungi Sherab, Gomjungi Sherab. You develop knowledge in three stages. One is by hearing the teachings at the foot of a qualified master. Second one, you go home and think about it logically. And then thirdly, you have all these mystical experiences. But you don't get the third one without the first two. And His Holiness, I was very gratified to hear him in Washington, D.C. He said, somebody said, can I meditate on one pointed, you know, concentrated on emptiness? And he said, no, study, study, study. And then he, you know, and then he said that. And then he went on to describe how important it was to have a foundation in a Buddhist education, formal Buddhist education. Then go home and think about it, contemplate it, think about it at home, and then go into these deep meditative states and see those things directly. But it's impossible to get to the third without the first two. And that's what the Buddha said. By the way, the words there, when it said, those with compassion use skillful means, taptul. That's the whole basis of what we're studying, tange. Taptul means sneaky ways of getting students to understand something, you know. And this is, if you know Nasruddin in the Sufi tradition, you know, he figures out a guy is attached to his house and he's invited to the person's house. So what does he do? He sets it on fire and leaves. Okay, meaning skillful means to prevent attachment, you know. He's being kind to this guy. He knows the guy is attached to his house. So he sets a big fire and he leaves, you know. And not quite like that, but skillful means meaning what? Vaibhashika, South Tarantika, and mind-only schools, you know, being in our discussion, in this context, things that were not exactly accurate, but that Lord Buddha taught as a skillful means to get people up one more step on the spiritual ladder, okay? And we'll talk more about that later. I think there's two main points to the study of Tange. One is, obviously, to understand emptiness, because all the questions revolve around emptiness. Secondly, to learn to be more, accepting of other people's viewpoints, because you never know if they're not some enlightened being who's trying to move certain percentage of people up a little bit higher. Okay? You don't know. If the Buddha could masquerade as a Abhidharmaist to get people up higher and teach things that are ridiculous, like partless atoms, to help people, to get them to move on farther, things that are clearly non-existent, things that are clearly not defensible. But Lord Buddha could seriously teach it with a straight face to people in order to help them and get them to move up farther, then we have to be careful about judging other spiritual traditions and things like that. Okay? Are they wrong? Yes. Are they unhelpful? maybe not. You see, and should you judge them, meaning, yeah, you can judge them if you're omniscient. Okay? If you're not, then reserve judgment. Okay? Like, maybe this guy is somebody special. So I won't judge him as a person. But I will, when the time comes and it's appropriate for a certain audience, attack him. They say, Sengengarochene means, with the roar of a lion, I will rip this guy apart and his wrong ideas about emptiness, for example, in public, when the time is right and when it's appropriate. But do I judge this person as being some kind of bad person or crazy person? Who knows, you know? If Lord Buddha could teach whole schools of thought that are not correct for the benefit of others, then maybe we better be careful who we judge, you know? Can we judge the viewpoint? Yes. And at the right time and in the appropriate circumstances, we should attack it and prove it wrong. But never judge the person and never be completely sure why they're taking that position. Okay? All right. Number three. Why do we have to learn to distinguish between the literal and the figurative? Why do we have to learn to interpret what the Buddha said in order to find out what he really meant? And the answer is this. You want to learn the true meaning of emptiness. Okay? Because Buddha taught emptiness in three wildly differing ways during the three turnings of the wheel. According to the mind-only school, how did it happen? Oh, in the first turning of the wheel, he said things had more self-existence than they really do. In the second turning of the wheel, he indicated that nothing had any nature of its own. And then in the third turning of the wheel, he fudged it. He said, you know, half the time I was speaking literally and half the time I was speaking figuratively, and some things do exist by definition and some things don't. Okay? That's the mind-only take on it. Middle way take on it, when he said things did exist by definition, he was just trying to be helpful to people who couldn't get it. Then in the second turning of the wheel, when he said nothing existed by definition, he was telling the truth. And in the third turning of the wheel, to those people especially who came up to him and said, did you really mean it when you said that during the second turning of the wheel? He says, you know, knowing immediately that they can't get it or can't take it, he starts to fudge it. Oh, no, I only meant it half the time. Okay? Like that. So the main reason to study, when was he teaching figuratively and when was he teaching literally, the main reason to discuss it is to understand emptiness more clearly. And I think you got that feeling in the last class we had, or the next last class, seven different definitions of emptiness. Okay? I mean, hopefully by the end of this class you can knock them out. You can say, oh, here's what this school believes, here's what this school believes, here's why that's wrong. Okay? And somewhere in there is your own belief about emptiness. And then you can identify which one you're stuck on and move up to the last one. And if Lord Buddha hadn't gone through teaching all those wrong ways, you wouldn't have been able to identify it. So thank you. You know, it's a skillful means. Number four. How do we judge what the Buddha meant figuratively and what the Buddha meant literally? And different schools have different ways of judging it, right? So, if Lord Buddha came out and said, this is how you know when I'm speaking figuratively, and this is how you know when I'm speaking literally, or if he comes out and says, I was speaking literally on that occasion, and I wasn't speaking literally on the other occasion, can you take him literally? The answer is no, okay? Not even on that, okay? When he comes out and says, oh, I was just kidding, and that's what I really meant, can you take that literally? No. No more than what he originally said. Okay? In the end, you must use reasoning. Okay? It has to make sense to you. Okay? In the end, what decides what's figurative and literal is what you yourself figure out to be true. Okay? It's your personal experience and your personal knowledge. And you're personally figuring out. And Lord Buddha said that. He quotes Lord Buddha, who said, you know, it's the example. I think that's the next question. Yeah. You know, three different tests to tell if something is true or not. And Lord Buddha goes through those. Okay? It's the example of the gold, testing gold. Okay? So you have to know that example. That example is one of the most famous examples in Buddhism, and you really should be able to rattle it off very quickly. Okay? We'll go through them. Okay. Yeah, one is you know, melt the gold, check it out in the fire. Secondly, cut it with some snips, you know, see if there's any copper inside or something like that. And then use a touchstone. Touchstone is like some kind of stone, and you rub it against it. And this is in the gold business. You can tell from the color of the mark that the gold leaves whether it's real or not, okay? Or what kind of caritage it is, okay? How pure it is. And these three tests refer respectively to, first one, the fire refers to checking with your own direct experience, whether this matches your own direct experience of things, whether that teaching matches your own direct experience. The cutting is comparable to your own deductions. Okay, does it match with what you can figure out on your own deductively? Okay. And thirdly, the touchstone is, does it match what people have said who you can establish with your own reasoning are people who could not lie to you? Okay. So that's sort of a people, you have to be sure about the third one, okay? Does the third one mean that anything Lord Buddha said is true? That's not the meaning of the touchstone. First you establish that a particular person cannot lie and would not lie, and then you establish, and then you can go on to say that what they said is accurate. But you don't just say, oh, whatever he said is accurate. Lord Buddha didn't want you to do that. That's why he taught the example of the gold. So when you present the example of the gold, you have to be very careful on number three. We're not saying that you should, Lord Buddha said to believe Lord Buddha whenever Lord Buddha said something. Okay? I mean, don't come out like that. It's, Lord Buddha said you can believe what a person says only on the condition that you have established that they cannot be lying or they cannot be wrong about that subject. And they would not claim to describe it if they didn't know it correctly. Okay? You got to distinguish between those two. How do you find out if a person is someone who can't lie? And then there's all these tests for that. Okay, the main one being the principal one, and in my own experience, this is the one I like the best, is that Lord Buddha has described suffering so eloquently and so exhaustively that to me, that's why I was attracted to Buddhism in the first place. You see, I mean, even the very bad translations I was reading at the time, it was clear that Lord Buddha had this position that the minute you start a relationship, for example, the seeds for the destruction of that relationship are already in it. You see what I mean? Or the minute you are born, your death is already part and parcel with your body and stuff like that. It just seemed to me to be totally correct. A description of what I was experiencing and what I could see in the world. So then you get a lot of faith in it when he gets to the description of how to get out of it. You see what I mean? Because no one else has described the situation correctly at all. You know, nobody when I was 20 years old was describing the situation correctly. And then I read that stuff, you know, Lord Buddha describing it. I'm like, he describes the problem so well, so perfectly that then you get some faith in his solution. Okay. All right, number five. Six? Number four had all that parts in it, okay. Number five is, you should know, if you claim to have studied the mind-only school, you better know the three attributes or the three groups into which they divide everything, okay? Which is Kundak, Shenwang, and Yongdrups, okay? Kundak meaning things that you construct mentally, imagined things, whether they are real or not, whether they correspond to something actual or not, okay? So a kundak that doesn't correspond to something real would be imagining, a flower that could grow in midair with no water, no soil, no nothing, no nutrients, no fertilizer. Some people translate it as sky flower. I don't like the translation much, you know? It means a flower growing in midair. That's the point of the example. And then an imagination that does exist is Michael Roach or something like that. Tashi, right? Thinking the idea of somebody, okay? The concept or the mental construct of a person, okay? What about Shenwang? Things which are at the mercy of others, Shenwang, okay? Meaning any changing thing in the world. And there's no discussion of whether they exist or not. They do exist, okay? Yongdru. Why is it called Yongdru? Why is it called totality? But why is emptiness in the minor league school called totality? Yongsu Drupa. Yeah, I guess Teacher Rinchen said, we asked him, you know, he said, what, you know, we were struggling with the English word to translate it during the classes, and he says, Yongsu Drupa means the minute it comes out, the minute something exists, its emptiness exists with it. You see what I mean? As soon as the thing is there, it is not something self-existent, okay? And then you could also say, it covers everything. Every object has its own emptiness. So you can call emptiness totality, meaning it covers the totality of things, or you can say total in the sense that the minute something pops into existence, it is totally not self-existent. Okay? Something like that. Okay. Number six. Constructs are said to, quote, lack any definitive nature or not exist by definition. Explain what it means in the mind-only school when they say that, and then explain what it means in the middle-way school when they say that. Okay? Two totally different things. Okay? Any ideas about what it means to exist by definition in the mind-only school? Yeah. Yeah, okay. You didn't just make it up in your mind. It exists from... Didn't we say it exists from its own side? Through its own unique way of being. Okay? Rangune Drupa. Rangitumamayami Dulusu Drupa. Okay? Not something just made up. Okay? Therefore, how many of the three categories exist by definition and how many don't? Yeah, two exist by definition, which is changing things and emptiness. Totality, and then one of them doesn't exist by definition, because it's just made up in the mind. It's just imagined. Kuntax, constructs. Okay. Middle way school. How do they say? Especially when I say middle way in the questions, and when Jetsun Kapa says middle way in the mind only presentation, he's mostly talking about higher middle way. Okay, Prasangika or consequence school. Okay, and what does he say? Nothing exists by definition, but why? When you look for the thing that got the label, the cylinder, before you put the label on, you'll never find anything. Okay? When you look for the thing that got the label, independent of the label, you'll never find anything. Okay? The pen, okay? The pen before you thought of the pen as the pen before you thought of the cylinder as a pen. Okay? Is the pen the... This is the famous Nagarjuna thing. I hate to make it less sexy or mystical, but here goes. I'm going to ruin it for you, okay? Is a thing any one of its parts? Is a car the tire of the car? No. Is the car all the parts of the car put together? According to Nagarjuna. You have to say no. Okay. Is it neither one of its parts or all of its parts together? No. Is it both? It's the tire by itself and all the parts together? No. And the trick is that number two means independently, by definition. Meaning before your karma has forced you to think as a car. Because that's the final part. If you count that among the parts, is a car the sum of its parts? Yes, okay, and that's all, it's just a trick question, okay? It's not very sexy. Okay, it's not like mystical or anything. Maybe a little bit. Okay. Number seven. In explanations of the process of making constructs that follow from the sutra references we just mentioned, a distinction is made between the dependent thing that is the object of the constructing state of mind, the constructing state of mind itself, and the construct that, quote, lies behind them. Explain these three as they occur in the example of the boy named Tashi. Okay, this is just the boy named Tashi is a beautiful introduction to the mind-only school's belief about how constructs are created. Okay, how your reality is created around you. It's a really good example. Some poor guy showed up last night at Sixth Street named Tashi. We all started giggling. You know, he wanted to know what's the problem. You know, okay. It took me like 20 minutes to explain to him because he never studied Buddhism, really. So, anyway, here we go. A man and his wife have a baby boy. About a day later, they choose the name Tashi for the boy. Tashi the boy, quote, is a construct that lies between the object it is applied to, which is that lump of flesh, okay, with the four things sticking out. And the constructing state of mind, which in this case is a metaphor, the metaphor is the father or the mother applying the name to the boy. Okay, so there is an object out here. There is a state of mind that's giving it a name. And in this case, it's the metaphor is the parents deciding on a name, which is the constructing state of mind and the basis for the construction. And then there's the construction made up somewhere between them, which is Tushy the boy. Okay, Tushy the boy. And if Tushy the boy was not a construct, then the minute he popped out, what? Everybody who never met the parents and who never talked to the parents should say, oh, Tushy the boy has been born. Okay? That's an example for how constructs are applied in the mind-only school. Okay. According to the mind-only school. And they say it's very difficult to get at the actual object. It veils, the construct veils the actual object, and you're never quite getting through the veil and like that. Okay? Okay, number 8. The sutra goes on to use the three expressions. That's a long story. Anyway, describe the interrelation of those three things, kundak, xianwang, yondu, which is very cool. Okay? You can describe them all with each other. Okay? It's very simple. Emptiness, meaning yondu, consists of the fact that certain non-existent kundaks, meaning wrong imagined ideas about the self-existence of something, don't apply to shenwangs. Okay? I'll say it again in English. Okay? This is the beauty of the mind-only school. This is the brilliant core one great thing about the mind-only school. Here it is. Emptiness, or you can say yongdu, totality. They would say totality, right? Consists of the fact that certain wrong kundaks, meaning mental ideas, constructs, imagined things, don't apply to shenwangs. Don't apply to shenwangs. So for them, the emptiness of this pen is the fact that, okay, so the emptiness meaning yongdu, right? There we got one covered already. The emptiness of this pen is the fact that certain ideas that I might have about the pen, like what in this school? Two of them. Two forms of emptiness in this school. That girl is so good. Nah, you don't really know. Okay. To them, there's two self-existent objects we're talking about here. One, a pen that could be called a pen by definition. A pen that could be the object of the name pen by definition. Was forever that way, will forever be that way, was that way naturally, in and of itself. It deserves to be called pen. Okay? Pen is the object of the word pen by definition. That's a non-existent kundan. Or, a pen is something that grows independent of the same karmic seed that creates my visual awareness of the pen. That's another complete lie, according to the mind-only school. And those two lies are non-existent objects, and the lack of them is emptiness. With regard to what? This shenwang. So there you got all. That's why Lord Buddha taught the three attributes of the mind-only school. Why? Because it's such a cool way to explain emptiness. One more time. The emptiness of the pen is the fact that two wrong ideas about it don't apply to it. In mind-only terms, the yongdup of the pen is the fact that two non-existent kundaks don't apply to this pretty little shenwang. Okay? Alright? In English, the totality of this pen is the fact that two non-existent constructs or concepts about it don't apply to this changing object or this dependent thing. Okay? That's all. Then you cover all three categories or groups of the mind-only system. And that's why Lord Buddha taught the mind-only school that way. And it's a nice way to get up to the Madhyamika, which is just a little shade more subtle, right? And we'll get to that. All right. Yeah, basically mind-only school is concerned that you might have two wrong ideas about this pen. What's the first one? That the pen could be the thing named the pen in and of itself. By definition. Okay? Which is very close to the middle way school. It's very close. It's kind of a nice bridge to the middle way school. Okay. Or they could say the second wrong idea would be to say that pen and the forces that brought about this pen, the forces that have brought this pen into this room for me to look at, and the forces that have brought me to be standing here and having an eye and an eye consciousness that could perceive it are totally unrelated. Okay? And that's not true. Okay? Certain forces, it's not true that this pen wandered into this room and I wandered into this room and we just bumped into each other. No such thing. A karmic event in the past happened. I was good to somebody or I was bad to somebody. It depends on whether you're hating this presentation tonight or enjoying it. Okay? And then it has created, simultaneously, it has brought about the pen and it has brought about me to be here. Okay? That's all. That's all. The day you met your boss was your fault. Okay? Put in other terms, okay? So don't get mad at him. All right. Number 9. Ooh, this is a long one, okay? Name the 3 famous turnings of the wheel of the Dharma, those 3 great convocations, and state, A, when were they primarily taught? B, where were they primarily taught? Primarily is such a nice word in debating. Tsor, say tsor. Tsor. It's the way to cover your rear end in the debate ground. Okay? There's always an exception to everything. You never say always. You say mainly or primarily or, you know, and then you get out of a lot of problems in the debate ground. Okay? They're basic subject matter. Same thing, right? And E, what from the point of view of the outcome of the exchange their view was on whether things have their own nature or not. What is the outcome of the exchange, by the way? You remember that the third turning of the wheel was triggered by a bodhisattva, Yamdapak, who asked the Buddha a question. Did you really mean it when you said everything was empty? Okay. And then Lord Buddha starts to clarify what he meant, according to the mind-only school at least. In the middle-way school, you'd say he was obfuscating what he meant. Okay. All right, got to get used to that. But, you know, he was clarifying what he meant. And then the Bodhisattva says, I get it. You didn't mean to say nothing had any definition of its own. You meant to say kuntaks don't have any definition of their own, but the other two do. I get it. That's called the outcome of the exchange. Okay. So from the point of the outcome of the exchange, what was the view on whether things had any nature of their own or not? Okay. Those are the questions for each turning of the wheel. Why? Because we are in the mind-only school. We are wearing mind-only hat for the first 8 classes of this course. Okay, then just so you didn't go away from the 7-year course with a mind-only hat on, we went up to the Svatantrika system, and then we went up to the Prasangika system. Okay, first turning of the wheel of Dharma. Its name is the turning of the wheel on the 4 truths. Okay, it was taught in Varanasi, okay? Varanasi. Okay? Near Sarnath. Sarnath near Varanasi. Okay? Taught in Sarnath near Varanasi. Disciples, those of the lower way. And we're going to get into lower way later. We're not dissing Hinayana. In this discussion, in this teaching, Hinayana means those who hold certain primitive ideas about emptiness. Okay. Basic subject matter. And by the way, it doesn't at all relate to country. Okay. There could be people in Burma, Sri Lanka, who have quite sophisticated viewpoints about emptiness, and there could be people in Tibet who are lazy and have a very Hinayana idea about emptiness. Okay. Or worse. All right. Oh, those are in the West. Okay. Basic subject matter for the 4 truths. You're not going to call them the 4 noble truths, please. Okay? Nothing noble about them. Everything the Lord Buddha taught was noble. Bad translation of Arya. Okay? Meaning someone who has seen emptiness directly. Okay? Viewpoint. Every existing thing exists by definition. Okay? Viewpoint according to whom? Yeah. Viewpoint especially according to the Bodhisattva who's just finished the exchange with Lord Buddha. I get it. During the first turn of the wheel, you said everything exists by definition. Okay. Okay, second turning of the wheel. Called the turning of the wheel on how nothing exists by definition. Seni mebe kinkor. Chunkor, sorry. Place, taught at Jagapumari. Okay. In Gyalpokup, which is what? Vulture's Peak near Rajagriha. Okay. Disciples. Tekchen. Interesting question. I don't think I went over it with you. According to the mind-only school, what kind of Mahayana disciples? Were there middle-way disciples sitting there during the second turning of the wheel? I mean, you might say no, but they say, yeah, there were, and they didn't take it to be literal. How's that? I mean, they would say that, okay? Yeah, mind-only school people would say that, okay? They'd say, greater way, that's us. But aren't you the disciples that Lord Buddha thought would be more comfortable with the presentation of saying nothing exists by definition? Yeah, because he knew we were so smart we wouldn't take it literally. Okay? I mean, there's a section where they get into a fight like that. You know, there's a section where they say, because they're trying to say, there's a section that says, disciples during the second turn of the wheel were very sharp, and they say, yeah, that was us. And we didn't take him literally, even as he spoke, you know, or something like that. Okay, there's a debate like that. Okay, basic subject matter. Emptiness, domani, shunyata. Viewpoint according to the mind-only school. Nothing exists by definition, which is a kundap or a drondot? Good question, for whom? For the mind-only school. Kundap, meaning you are totally dissing something that really exists. You are really in trouble. You are really expressing an extreme nihilistic, wild viewpoint. If nothing exists by definition, you have to be saying what? Nothing exists. Come on. Okay? Okay? For them, this is like total nihilism. Okay? To say that nothing exists by definition. Third turning of the wheel, called the turning of the wheel on fine distinctions. Distinctions between what? Hey, this exists by definition and this doesn't. Okay? I was just kidding, okay? This stuff does and this stuff doesn't. And he makes a fine distinction, okay? Taught at Vaishali, Yangbuchen, okay? Disciples, quote, those of all ways, which we later corrected to... Huh? What did those of all ways mean? We later corrected this. We corrected it from a monastic textbook. Do you remember? I don't remember. Huh?
It's somebody who understood.
No, I said those who enter all the ways, but it was something much more sophisticated.
Those who understood.
No.
Isn't it those that didn't need the fine distinctions?
No. Good. Yeah. It meant people of the higher way, because they would have necessarily already understood the presentation of emptiness in the lower way. It didn't mean Mahayana and Hinayana people. Okay, that was a correction that I made after reading the monastic textbook. Okay, meaning all those who have entered all the ways, meaning those of the higher way who have obviously already understood the presentation of emptiness by the lower way. Okay, and in that sense, it's made for people of all the ways. Okay. Because it wouldn't make much sense otherwise. Especially from the mind-only point of view, if the third turning of the wheel is for the most smart people or something like that. Okay? Alright. Question number 10. Basically, which of the three turnings of the wheel are literal and figurative according to the mind-only school, and then which of the three turning of the wheels are literal or figurative according to the middle-way school? Mind-only school. Is the first turning of the wheel literal?
No.
No, why not? It's not true that everything exists by definition. Is the second turning of the wheel literal? Mind-only school.
No.
No, because it's not true that nothing exists by definition. Is the third turning of the wheel literal?
Yes,
because it is true that some things are and some things aren't. That's all, easy. Now what about middle-way school?
No, yes.
Yeah, she said for a different reason, okay? Let's first ask, by the way, they don't use the words literal and figurative. They use face value or not face value, okay? Middle way school. So you have to distinguish between literal and face value and figurative and not on face value. They have different meanings to the middle way school. Okay, middle way school. Can you take the first turn of the wheel on face value? No. Can you take the second turn of the wheel on face value? Yes. Can you take the third turn of the wheel on face value? No. Okay. In the middle way school.
Second turn by face value?
Is face value. Yeah, because they think that's the correct one, right? I think Buddha is...
No, you can take it literal, but not by face value.
No, I think you can take it on face value.
Didn't they say even in Latin, take it on face value, but you can take the second...
Let me see here. It is true that nothing exists by definition. So, the first and the last, it says in the answer key, the first and the last are not to be taken on face value. But the middle one is, because it is true that nothing exists by definition as stated in the middle one. And it's not true that everything exists by definition as stated in the first. And it's not true that some things do and some things do not exist by definition as stated in the third. So you can't take them on face value. Okay. Now, when you say literal or figurative, in the middle way school, it means something totally different. What does it mean? All I said was face value. I didn't say literal or figurative. Literal means, in the middle way school, any scripture which talks directly about emptiness. And figurative means anytime he didn't speak directly or clearly, they say clearly about emptiness. Okay. Why would you make that distinction between what the Buddha really meant and what the Buddha didn't really mean? You know, why don't you say that literal means when he meant what he said and figurative means when he didn't mean what he said? Because that's not what they say. They say literal means anytime he was talking about emptiness clearly, and figurative means anytime he wasn't talking about emptiness clearly. Why would they change the word around like that? Why would they change the meaning of that word around like that?
Because
the whole point is emptiness. Okay, the whole point of this whole exercise is emptiness. The whole point of this return of the wheel is emptiness. You see emptiness directly one time, 20 minutes, all your problems are over. You know, all your problems are over. You are in a realm by mistake. You are in this realm by accident, by cruel, deadly accident. And if you don't see emptiness directly, you'll be here for longer, much longer. And the minute you see emptiness directly, you see the whole thing is over. You see directly the whole story is over with. You're not in this realm. You won't be in this realm anymore. You can no longer collect the kind of karma which can ripen into suffering this realm. You're out of here. Just 20 minutes, okay? That's the whole point. It all boils down to that. You know, can you see it or can you not see it before you die? Okay. All right. Number 11. And seeing it really depends on study like this. And it sinks into your mind, and I'm not exaggerating, it directly correlates to how much you study about it. And on the day that you see it directly, it will be very, very much because you have been studying it quite seriously and meditating well and serving a Lama well. And all of those conditions make it happen. And mainly the study and the service, okay? That's really how you do it. Okay. Number 11. What does it mean here? What is the real criterion that decides whether a person belongs to the, quote, lower way or the higher way, Hinayana or Mahayana, okay? Nothing to do with what country they live in. Not really anything to do in this context about whether they have compassion or not, okay? Read the Abhidhamma Kosha. You're supposed to practice Buddhism to save all beings. I mean, you think they don't say that? They have the word Bodhisattva in the Abhidhamma Kosha. You can check it on the computer, you know, it's there. You know, I mean, the main point here is that we are here calling a person Hinayana, and any of us could be a Hinayana by that measure, by how sophisticated is their idea about emptiness. How far along are they in understanding emptiness? And then the second half, you know, the higher two schools, meaning mind only and middle way, they have a more sophisticated understanding of emptiness. And then, so you're in a higher knowledge, which means Abhidharma, or sutrist school, those are both Hinayana, because they have certain primitive ideas about what emptiness, I mean relatively primitive, way beyond us, okay? And they have certain ideas about emptiness. And when you get into middleway school and the middle, sorry, mind-only school and middleway school, then it's much more sophisticated. That's all. What does it mean to turn the wheel of the Dharma? To answer this question in a sweet way, okay, you have to distinguish between the two kinds of the wheels of Dharma. What are they? Yeah, Lungi Chungor and Dobi Chungor, which means the physical Dharma teaching, and then the physical Dharma, meaning the teachings, tape recordings, CD-ROMs, paper books, lectures, okay, shrugs, okay. No, really, you know, are things self-existent, you know. Okay, those are all physical Dharma teachings. And then there's the realizations in the hearts of living beings, okay, Tonglong, direct perception of emptiness, stuff like that. I mean, in the Abhidharma system especially, that is the wheel of the Dharma, okay? So the point is that the teacher sets one in motion, meaning the physical wheel of the Dharma, and then that triggers in the mind stream, in the heart of the student, the realizations that are the wheel of the Dharma. So I like to see it as two gears locking, like you're looking for each other, you go through your teenage years messing around, then me, and then you go through your 20s, you know, like trying, looking for your spiritual master, and then suddenly you hook up, and I see this gear thing, you know, the spiritual master's turning this, and then that starts to turn, you get close enough to them, and then the gear touches your gear, and then sets it in motion, and then you can imagine that happening down thousands of years, you see, this gear catching that gear and setting it in motion, and then when they grow up, they hit the next gear, and that's a lineage, and that's the wheel of the Dharma, and that's what that wheel means. Okay, physically, that's why they draw a spoked wheel like that. Okay. Number 13. Name three goals that the commentary on the true intent. Samdinir Mochana Sutra, okay? Dodigongja, which is the main sutra for the mind-only school. Okay, they say that's where the Buddha really said what he meant, okay? And then you're going to get a different sutra when you come to India and hear Geshe Thich Nhat Hanh do the second half, when he gets into the Madhyamika, because they'll take a different sutra. Lodumisebe Shubhido, the sutra of never-ending wisdom. Then you're going to get the middleway school saying, no, 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 this is the main sutra. This is the sutra where he really said what he meant, okay? So we're back in the mind-only school sutra. The minute you hear a commentary on the true intent, you know that we're talking mind-only school, and your answer better be mind-only school, okay? Who wrote this commentary? Which part of the Tengyur is it in? It ain't in the Tengyur, okay? Because it's not a commentary. I mean, it is a commentary. It's an auto-commentary. Okay? It's Lord Buddha telling you what he really meant. You know, I remember searching through Tengyur catalogs for weeks, you know, looking for this text, you know, because it says commentary. It's not a commentary. It's a sutra called What I Meant in My Other Sutras. All right? You got to get used to that. Okay, three goals he had. Lord Buddha had when he taught that sutra, and why he divided the three turnings of the wheel into figurative and literal. Why go through this trouble? I mean, now you understand why he taught those three characteristics of the mind-only school. They are cool when you understand the interaction, how they work together. You know, Yongdrus is the absence of certain kuntaks on top of certain shenwangs. Okay, that's cool. But why did Lord Buddha go into this thing of dividing each turning of the wheel? Oh, this one's figurative, this one's literal, this one's not. You know, why trouble? Why not just give one turning of the wheel and say what you mean? Okay, here it is. The sutra wants to prevent us from taking on face value the blanket statements that either A, everything exists by definition, or B, nothing exists by definition. So, you know, answer part one of three parts, right, is the sutra doesn't want us to take blanket statements correct as being true. Okay, from the mind-only point of school, both of those blanket statements is wrong. What? Everything exists by definition, or nothing exists by definition. Okay. Number two, the sutra wants to inform us which of the three groups exist by definition and which don't. Okay? What? Total emptiness and dependent things do exist by definition, and constructs don't exist by definition. So it wants to teach us about those three categories and tell us which ones do exist by definition and which don't. Okay? Number three, the sutra wants to provide us with an effective way of understanding emptiness. How? Cool. Very cool. By understanding the interrelationship between those three categories. Okay? Yongdrups is the lack of certain kuntas on top of certain shenwangs. Okay? So it's giving you a good tool for understanding emptiness. And those are the three goals of the sutra. Don't take blanket statements. Understand which of the groups are exist by definition and don't. And then finally, understand how this is a very cool way to teach emptiness by thinking of things in these three categories. Okay. Number 14. There are some other Buddhist groups who come along and say all three turnings of the wheel were literal. And there were some thinkers in Tibet who came along and said the Buddha was being literal in during all three turnings of the wheel. Now during the first turning of the wheel, Lord Buddha, to accommodate some non-Buddhists, even seemed to say that you had some kind of existing soul or self or something like that. You know, he even seemed to say something like that. Okay, what did he really mean? Okay, if you take that statement as literal, which these Tibetan schools do, then you have to say a certain very weird thing. They interpret it to mean that you have a little Buddha inside of you. It's called Buddha nature. Okay. They say, Lord Buddha was referring to your Buddha nature, and right under your skin, there's a real Buddha already there. You just have to peel it off. You know, I've heard this over and over again. I've seen it. You know, Buddha nature means you really are a nice person, and you just have to reveal yourself. You know, and all people were made nice. All people were made enlightened. And all you have to do is just shine it up a little bit, and you'll see. You know, and then they explain Buddha nature like that. Is it wrong?
Yes.
Yes. Is it useful?
Yes.
Maybe, for some people. So do we judge the people who say that?
No.
No. In fact, if you do, you break your first bodhisattva vow. Got to be careful here. Okay? First bodhisattva vow. Dr. Shimon Chinomi Tenshin. Dr. doesn't mean just generally praising yourself. If that was the first bodhisattva vow, life would be hopeless. You know? For me, anyway. But what it means is specifically to criticize other Dharma paths, okay, like that. Judge them. Okay. So is it right? No. Is it maybe useful? Perhaps. When people are mature enough, is it important to unteach them that? Yes. Okay. All right. So what does Buddha nature mean? The emptiness of your body and mind. The Buddha never said and never meant that there's some kind of thing inside of you. The only thing about you which is right now is your emptiness. That's the only thing you get to take to the bank. Okay, the only part of you that's still going to be there when you get enlightened. What? You think you get to keep a certain part of your fingernails? Do you think a certain part of your liver or intestines is something good? You know what I mean? There's no physical part of you that's still going to be the same when you get there. And there's basically no mental part of you which is omniscient yet. So that's not going to be there either. Fortunately, you do have one part which is still going to be there when you get there, which is your emptiness. How about your name?
Nope.
You don't keep your name either. They won't call you Jay or whatever when you get enlightened, okay? So the only part of you that you get to keep is your Buddha nature, which is the emptiness of your body and mind. Thank God my arm is empty. Because then I can look down on it someday and see it as Manjushri's arm. Or Tara's arm. Okay, Tara. Okay. You get to be whatever you want. Okay. 15. Who is the great innovator who revived the mind-only school system in this world? What book did he base his work on? And how do we know that this was the book? Okay. On how do we know? This is weird. I better read that question again. Okay, anyway. By the way, it's important to say that Master Sangha did not invent the mind-only school, he just revived it. Who invented it? Lord Buddha. It was a useful tatsu. It was a useful, skillful means. Okay? Then it kind of got obscured for a while, and then Arya Sangha brought it back. Okay? It's like certain kinds of music. He used what scripture to revive that system? The commentary on the true intent. The sutra in which the Buddha explains what he meant in all his other sutras. Okay. How do we know that this is a book he based it upon? He mentions it in several of his works. He says, I'm basing this system on that sutra. Okay. Let me see. We'll do one more and then I'll give you a break, okay? Since everyone is asleep. This innovator sets forth the meaning of thusness, or emptiness, largely through a description of the two extremes and how to avoid them. Name the two states of mind that hold to these two extremes. By the way, important to make the distinction between the extreme and the mind which is holding to the extreme. Okay, technically speaking, does the extreme exist? No, because the extreme is the object of the wrong idea. It is the rabbit with two heads. That's what we call the extreme. And then there's the tendency of the mind to grasp onto that extreme, and that's called grasping to the extreme. So learn to distinguish between extreme is a technical word in Buddhism that refers to the non-existent thing that your mind thinks is there. And then there's the state of mind which grasps to that extreme. And those are two different things. Okay? Two totally different things. Okay? First, I think you can say, I get out of it, I fudge it by saying extreme way of thinking. How's that? Which to me means the state of mind which is holding to that non-existent extreme. How's that? Okay. So what are they? They're called Dzondok and Kundep. Say Dzondok. Kundep. Dzondok. Kundep. Dzondok means seeing something there when there's nothing there. Kundep means denying the existence of something that really is there. For example, in the general confession, what does it say? Pape gendin la kua dapa dang. Okay, pape gendin la kua dapa means please forgive all the times that I made a mistake and assume that somebody had not seen emptiness directly when perhaps they had. Okay? That's denying something that does exist there. See, kundap can also mean with people. Kundap means to say definitively, my boss doesn't have a single good quality about him. Okay? That's a kundap. Okay? Dondok is like, oh, you know, I went to this lecture, the Lama had this really nice smile, you know, he's a bodhisattva. Okay, I mean, you hear that, okay? One is Dzondok, one is Kundep, okay? You don't know, you know, you really don't know. You don't know in either case, okay? And we call them in English concocting things and discounting things, okay? Okay? Concocting meaning, that's a good word in English because it means totally to make up something that's not there. What is the usual thing you're concocting? A self-existent thing, okay? A boss who is bad from his own side, a person who irritates you who is bad from their own side, and not because your stupid mind is projecting them. Okay? You're making up this person who irritates you. And then you get more angry at them, okay? And assure that you're going to meet them further, okay? That's the way the wheel of life spins. That's the way you create your suffering and maintain it so nicely, okay? Kundep being what? Yeah, discounting what in terms of Madhyamika or about emptiness? What about mind-only school? What would be a Kundep? Yeah, she said a good answer. Those stupid middle-way people. Things which obviously exist by definition. Pens which obviously exist from their own side. They go around saying, this is being projected by your mind. Oh, well then I'll make it $100 bill. You know, come on. You know, what's wrong with you guys? Alright? That's obviously a kundam. Okay? It doesn't, obviously it exists by definition. Don't say it doesn't exist by definition. Don't say it doesn't have any nature of its own. It obviously has some nature of its own. Everybody in this room sees it as a pen, right? Okay, have some refreshments. Okay. This is a reception we're planning for late March, early April. The release of the fourth CD along with a lot of images. some wood-carved images from Russia, about, I think, 400 of them or something. And it's going to be some like really nice reception, maybe 100 or 200 people, and it's to acquaint people with the new release. On that release will be 150,000 pages of scripture that we've completed so far. And it'll be on one CD, and we'll be giving it away. And it'll also be on the web for free download. So if you'd like to help with that reception, it's being managed by Mercedes, who's right here, with Ian, wherever he is. Where is Ian? Okay. And John Brady is generally helping out with that too. But talk to Mercedes. We'll need like a lot of volunteers, and it'll be a lot of fun, I think. Okay? All right. Oh, last I'd like to introduce Joan Stigliani. Where is she? Yeah, higher. She's one of the very nice group of, I think it started as a group of 40 people who went to Pomaia, Italy to study with a Geshe there for a 7-year course. And they're about 2 years finished? Or?
Finished 1 year.
And they're really doing a nice job, and I want to congratulate them. She's representing them, okay? They're on break right now. They get a certain amount of time off each year. And they're very serious, and they're doing very nice study there. So I want to welcome you and congratulate you. Okay. Okay. The question 17 says, describe in a brief sentence the middle way idea about the two extremes, meaning Drondok and Kundev, right? And concocting in the middle way version would be to say, if something exists, it must exist by definition. Okay? That's an extreme. Why? Because it doesn't exist. Okay? The fact that if something exists, it must exist by definition is an extreme. First of all, it just doesn't exist at all. That fact doesn't exist. It's not a fact. It's an untruth. It's a falsity. Okay? It's not true that if something exists, it must exist by definition. That's false. It doesn't exist. In the middle way school. Yeah. 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 Jay says, you know, the mind tends to concoct it and then forget that it concocted it. Of course, yeah. You dearly believe that your boss is bad from his side. Every person that you ever got angry at, you dearly believe that they are irritating from their own side. You and that's where all your suffering. Yeah, there is some kind of thing where you make up something and still remember. But we're talking about making up something and not even being aware that you're making it up, okay? Then the opposite of that is, if something did not exist by definition, then what would the mind-only school say? You know, and if it were a Shenwang, for example, it'd have to not exist at all. If you had a pen that didn't exist by definition, that must not exist at all, okay? And that would be Kun Dep. That would be discounting something. Okay. What, according to the middle way school, is the meaning of ultimate or ultimate reality? Okay, remember that for them it's different from existing ultimately, or okay, there's a big difference between ultimate existence and existing ultimately. Nothing exists ultimately, but everything exists nominally, and emptiness is the ultimate or ultimate reality. Okay, so you have to be careful when you get to middle way. Ultimate reality is emptiness. But nothing exists ultimately, which means, could mean a dozen things, but you could say, independent of your projections forced on you by your past karma. No such thing. Okay? From its own side, say. Okay. How does the middle way school describe deceptive reality? You could say it's the kind of reality that deceives a certain state of mind. Okay, deceptive reality in the middle way school is a kind of reality that deceives a certain state of mind. What state of mind? The state of mind itself is called the deceived, And that's why that reality is called deceptive reality. Okay? Why is it deceptive? Why is anything deceptive in the whole world? Why can you say someone deceived me? Because they presented themselves one way and the reality was a different way. Okay? When there's a discrepancy between the way they're presenting themselves and the way they really are, we call it deceiving me. And that's exactly what deceptive reality means. It appears to be self-existent, and it's not. Especially to a mental affliction. You can say it that way. You know, if you have a mental affliction towards anything, you must at that same moment be misperceiving them. They must be deceiving you. You can't get mad at your boss and at the same moment realize that you're creating them with your projection. You can't. You can't be aware that if you're mad, you're going to make him come back the next day and at the same time be mad at him. It's impossible. They can alternate very quickly, as you may experience when you're trying to practice. Okay? Technically speaking, they can't exist in the same mind at the same time. Okay? They can alternate at about 165, I think, you know. Like, wisdom is like, gets in a punch, you know, and then anger, you know. And then the idea is that the fight gets more and more fair as time goes on. Okay. Number 20. How does the mind-only school draw the difference between, quote, ultimate reality and, quote, deceptive reality? I think basically it's the difference between existing by definition or not. Is that true, Shilton? He says no. Give an example. Shenwang's?
Yeah. This pen is an example of reality, but it exists. But there's something wrong with it. Something they wouldn't say it doesn't exist.
It's not ultimate existence, but it exists ultimately. How's that? But it's an example of deceptive reality. How's that? How's that?
Can you say
I'm kind of unclear on this. Like, I think you could say that even the pen, according to the mind-only school, is an example of what we call deceptive reality. Like, Kuntaks and Shenwangs are deceptive reality, and Yongdup is ultimate reality. But you can say in the mind-only school that Shenwangs exist ultimately, whereas in the middle-way school you can't say that. Something like that? Okay. What should we say? Well, that's okay. I gotta work on that. Okay, I'll work on that. Maybe you should take it out. Maybe I'll put the answer in your final. number 21. 21 and 22 are basically questions about external objects, just existing as external objects. And I was gonna not put them in, and then I decided to put them in because I don't want you guys ever thinking that the mind-only school means that they think everything is your mind or something like that, okay? I mean, I put them in the final because I wanted you to recall or to remember that in the mind-only school, the word mind-only doesn't have anything to do with them not believing that this thing is outside of me or something like that, okay? And this is a totally, this is Geshe Thupten Rinchen's presentation, which was very beautiful. And he just did it as a side thing one day. He wasn't like, it wasn't what he was talking about, and he went into it, and we were all thrilled because we'd always wondered about it. Okay, so question 21: how does the consequence part of the middle way school describe what it means to exist as an external object? Okay, that just means not subsumed by my consciousness. Okay, if you poke this paper with a pin, I don't go ouch. Okay, and you know there's a debate about your hair, the end of your hair, if you have. It's not Gyukiduba, Rang Gyukiduba. It's not subsumed by your awareness. Like if you cut it, you don't go ouch, okay? But if you pull it, the follicles, they say, are Gyukiduba. So you get this feeling. So basically, I mean, in the highest schools of Buddhism, do external objects exist? Yeah. What are they? Well, they're not part of me. They're outside there, you know? That's all. Nothing complicated, okay? Nothing mystical, you know? It's out there. It's not part of me. Okay? That's all. So does the highest school of Buddhism, Madhyamika Prasangika, accept the existence of external objects? Well, yeah, of course they do. Why? Oh, because there's this paper out there and it's not me, and if you stuck a pin in the paper, I wouldn't go out. Okay? Something like that. All right? It's not subsumed by my immediate sense consciousness or something like that. Question 22. This question has two parts. What do members of the mind-only school, and then in parentheses it says, and those and the independent Madhyamikas who lean towards them. Okay, so we're talking mind-only school and mind-only school leaners. Okay, in the middle way school. Have in mind when they say nothing exists as an external object. All they have in mind is that nothing exists as an external object in the way that the lower two schools present it. Okay, that's all. That's all. Existing through some kind of partless atoms or something like that. Okay, that's all. When they okay, that's very important. Okay, I mean now you should go around clarifying that idea in people's minds. Okay, especially Western scholars who are very attracted by the idea that there's a school of Buddhism that says everything is in your mind, everything is in your head. You know, it's sexy, and nobody ever said that. Okay. Do they accept the existence of plain old external objects? Yeah, as long as you describe them as coming from the same karmic seed as the, you know, that's okay. Do they accept the existence of external objects as they are described by the materialists, the scientists, you know, who think everything is, that the ultimate reality is some kind of atom, you know, that's what builds reality, is atoms. I mean, this is, scientists go in the Abhidharma school probably, that the ultimate reality boils down to atoms, you know, that they don't accept that. They don't accept external objects like that. Do they accept that external objects built of atoms, particles? Sure. Okay. The only problem is they don't believe in atoms that don't have any sides or don't have any parts. An atom that is so small that you could no longer split it. Well, come on. If it didn't have width, then what would it be? They would all be touching each other on every side. Okay, got it? Which means they'd all be one atom and all the other atoms wouldn't exist, or something like that. It's impossible. Okay? That's all. What does the consequence group and the independents who lean the other way, meaning the sutras way, have in mind when they say that they are wrong? Huh? They say, by the way, there's one similarity between the highest Madhyamika and the sutras. Explain the idea of external objects. Who is that? I'm sorry. Highest Madhyamika, which means Prasangika. And then those people in the independent group who are leaning towards the sutras, okay? They say, look, when we say we do accept or we don't accept external objects, it's not necessary that we're defining them in the way that the lower two schools define them, okay? In other words, when a Prasangika guy gets up and says, I do accept external objects, he's not saying, I accept external objects as they're presented by the lower two schools. Because a mind-only school guy gets up and says, I don't accept external objects. And they say, why? He says, because if I did, I'd have to accept it the way they think it exists. Okay? That's all. The higher school, Prasangika, and the half of the independents who lean towards the sutras, they say, come on, you don't have to deny the existence of external objects just because those guys think that's what an external object means. You can just say external objects exist the way I want them to, which is just as something outside of myself, okay? And then the mind-only school says, no, when you say external object, you mean one made of partless atoms. We can't accept it. Okay, that's all. Okay. Mm-hmm. Lots of yawns out there. Okay. But you get it. 23. What does the mind-only school mean when they say the valid perception, which is the subject that perceives the pen, and the pen itself are of the same substance? Means they come from one karma. They come from one karmic seed. They're both growing from... There's no coincidences. You never have a strange encounter of the third kind or whatever, you know? There's no such thing as an encounter. It's not like the pen is coming from the factory and makes it to this school. Michael Roach comes from 6th Street and makes it to the school, and they bump into each other. There's never anything like that. It is a creation of my karma, and I'm a creation of my karma, and that's why they're bumping into each other, okay? At the same time. They're both growing from my, they're both growing and being sustained by my own karma at the same time. Okay? That's a real mind-only school favorite thing to talk about. Okay? And emptiness is the fact that it's nothing else is true. No other way of being is true. Okay? That's one of their flavors of emptiness. Okay. 24. Well then, why do they call them the mind-only school? You know, if it's not that they believe, if they do believe in external objects, and if it's not that they think that the pen is part of my mind, which was covered in the last two questions, okay, then what's the thing should pop into your mind next? Well, then why the hell are they calling the mind-only school? Okay? Why call them the mind-only school? And what does Jetsun Kapa say in his Gombarabsa? Very famous. Okay. He says, sutra, he quotes the sutra of the 10th level called Satchubedo. Okay? Sutra of the 10th Bodhisattva level. Okay? Which says, that sutra says directly, quote, these three realms of existence, meaning everything that exists in samsara, are mind only. It says mind only. Meaning what? Yeah, meaning mainly the main, well he says, quote, and I think it's nice if you quote it, okay, the mind is the main thing. Okay, mind only means the mind is the main thing. As far as what? As far as the creation of your reality. Meaning, and at that point, that sutra is denying the existence of a creator God. And that, in that context, the Buddha says, it's mind, man. It's not God, okay? It's not God made AIDS, cancer, automobile accidents, kids getting burned by napalm, or cruise missiles, or something like that, okay? It's not that that's made by a creator God. It's made primarily by mind having collected karma and then projecting stuff. That's all. It's not saying that a cruise missile is made of mind or something like that. Okay? And that's not the point. Yeah?
Just a quick question. The mind-only school, how do you define, or how do they define how a thing comes from its own side? Because that's something I haven't really been quite clear on.
He says, when the mind-only school says things come from their own side, what do they really mean? And, you know, fortunately we had a very good explanation of it. The expression in Tibetan is, "Yu rangi tumo mayembe duluki ngune dupa." Yu rangi tumo mayembe duluki ngune dupa. Okay? Which means the thing exists from its own side with some unique nature of its own. Okay? Some unique identity of its own. And then the text said, what are they mainly talking about when they say that? And they say, in the mind-only school's mind, okay, according to them, the fact that that pen comes from causes which are themselves out there, okay, then the thing they produce must be out there too. That's their main shtick. You know, if you ask a mind-only school person, what are you thinking of when you say that thing has to have its own identity from its own side? They say, you know, if you tell me I'm projecting this pen, then what about all the stuff that went into making the pen? You know, why do you have to have a factory? Why do you have to have petroleum? You know, why do you have to have somebody design it? Why do you have to have a store? You know, if it wasn't made from its own, you see, Madhyamika and mind only are both kind of saying that things are a creation of your projections, which is why you can become a Buddha. And they're saying, no, 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 come on. Those things are being produced from the bottom, you see? From those outside causes are producing these things. And we say, no, the main thing is karma is expressing itself through your mind and you're seeing them. You're making them what they are. You see what I mean? And you get into fierce debates with people. How can you get rich? How can you make things go the way you want in your life? Are you going to be... And this is very important. Maybe this is the most important thing to say about this class. Are you going to be a mind-only person who truly believes that to make something happen in your life you must correctly manipulate outer circumstances? Or are you going to clean up the things around you by working on your own mind and your own book and your own morality? What's the better way to do it? Buddhism says that the external thing does not work. You know, it doesn't matter how cleverly you make a presentation. It doesn't matter what kind of printer you use. The font doesn't matter. Ultimately, all of that is meaningless. All that matters is, were you generous in your past? You know? And then suddenly this guy won't care what the font is, or whether you used colored pictures, or whether they're crooked or not, or something like that. You see what I mean? And it's very hard to hold that line. It's extremely hard to hold that line. Things are not created by external causes. Okay? Those are not the thing. The thing is, the only thing that determines whether your proposal is successful or not is whether you've been generous. Period. You know? And if you made a lousy proposal or lost the proposal on the way to the sponsors, or the dog spilled coffee on it, or chewed it, or whatever, and if you still have the karma, then when you got there, they would award you the money. You know? And you've had the opposite experience countless times. It's spotless, it's perfect, the numbers all add up, you put in sexy pictures, and you went there and they said, she left yesterday and she left a message that you don't have to bother. You know, that's the way it is, you know, really, okay? You know, things are not created by that. They are created by karma, okay? That's all, yeah. And by the way, the other viewpoint is mine only, you see? And that's the answer to your question. The other viewpoint is mine only. You know, this thing is going to succeed or not succeed on the basis of my external efforts and not on the basis of whether or not I've kept my morality and my book and my vows. Okay? Very interesting. And any other viewpoint is mine only. Okay? Yeah?
I know it's necessary then to try, but why?
She says, I know it's necessary to try, then but why? Why try, you know? Why... I mean, there's a thing where, as I was just saying, the question is really this. If it's not the aspirin that removes your headache, then why ever take aspirin? You see what I mean? If whether or not the aspirin works is going to be determined by your karma and not anything in the aspirin. You see, to believe that the aspirin works because of some chemical in the aspirin is a mind-only school viewpoint. To believe that the aspirin works because you alleviated other people's pain in the past is a middle way viewpoint. And then some people want to fudge it. And I think you have to discuss this question deeply. Some people want to fudge it. They divide between causes and factors. Okay? They say the good karma is the cause and the factor is the aspirin. Okay? And then the aspirin becomes an independently existing thing, you see. Because it has some power in and of itself to cure your headache. But the main cause is your karma. You see what I mean? They're like giving it 50-50. They're saying that the chemicals in the aspirin are 50% effective and 50% karma. So, you know, 50% effective from their own side and 50% karma. And if you didn't take the aspirin, you wouldn't get, your headache wouldn't go away. You know what I mean? Something like that. And I think I've heard that from very convincing people say that. And I think you have to think about it very, very carefully. You have to think about it very, very carefully. I'll say this. I mean, the karma that would allow you to meet a doctor and the karma, or let's say the karma to be able to afford a good specialist and the karma to be cured are similar. But it's not necessarily that the specialist is who's curing you. Maybe you get used to that idea. Okay? The karma to run into a specialist who's good is very close to the karma of them being able to cure you. But obviously they're not the same thing. I mean, because you can have specialists who kill you. And people are. People do get killed by high-paid specialists. You know? So obviously what's really curing you is something else. Okay? That's a delicate thing. And you have to, that's by the way a very delicate wrong view, I think, and you have to think about it carefully. People will give you that spiel. I believe in that spiel sometimes, and I have to talk myself out of it, you know what I mean? Would you get cured anyway if you didn't take the aspirin? Yeah. Yeah, you would. Does that mean you shouldn't take aspirin? No. And you've got to get used to that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, then there's no such thing as aspirin that doesn't work, then, is what you're saying. He's saying you have to divide between aspirin that works and aspirin that doesn't work. I understand. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could say that, but no, I'd say, no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I wouldn't hold that viewpoint. That you can only call it aspirin if it does work, I wouldn't say. Because then you couldn't say the aspirin didn't help today. See? Anyway.
My question is, before you mentioned that, to be careful of considering the aspirin as a factor, because then it would become a self-factor.
What I'm saying is that be careful of thinking that my karma is the main thing and the aspirin helps. I think that's a wrong view.
Right.
You see what I mean? Any percentage of the aspirin that helps can only be your karma also. You see what I mean? That's what I'm saying.
Well, my question is that it seems as though karma and virtue have some kind of self-existing nature in there, in that system. And that's what I'm trying to reconcile, because you're saying, well, it's not the factor of the aspirin. But then yet, in this world of no self-natures, it seems that there's a subtle self-nature to virtuous actions, to being different from other actions, and karma as in being some kind of, from its own side, continual.
Yeah, I mean, Buddha said, Jinbe Longju Timgi De, very famous. Jinbe Longju means, give away your money, you'll get rich. Timgi De, keep your morality, you'll be happy all the time. Okay. That relationship between doing something good and getting something good back would seem to be self-existent. I mean, you hear that. People say that, which means, could it ever be different? And you say, no, it could never be different. And then they say, well, then it must be self-existent. You see what I mean? In that case, your arm could always only be a hand and never a paw. You know what I mean? I don't think you can say it that way. I don't think it follows. I don't think it follows from that. Why? I think certain... If an action harms somebody else, then yeah, it's always the case that it will harm you back because of the nature of perception. Does that mean that the laws of karma are not empty? I don't think so. Still, you're just projecting it. When you see the fact that good deeds cause pleasure and bad deeds cause pain, that's still a projection. Okay. Does the fact that it's invariable mean it's not a projection? I think not. I don't think you have to say that. You got to cook that. Yeah, yeah.
Is there some contradiction in saying that things, external objects, arise from their own causes and conditions, and yet they arise, that both the mind perceiving them and the object both arise from the same karmic causes?
Yeah, I don't think that a mind only, I don't think that the middle way prasangika, for example, would have a problem saying, and they don't have a problem saying, it's true that fruit trees grow from their seeds, and it's true that they don't grow through self-existent means. I don't think they'd have a problem with that. They'd say, the seeds are a projection, the sprout is a projection, the water is a projection, the fertilizer is a projection, and they always accompany trees that grow that way. But then they say, go down to hell, there are shamali knife trees that grow there and cut people open, and don't, they grow without water, and they live there in a very hot place, they couldn't grow like that. It's impossible to grow like that in our realm, according to the rules of our realm. But they grow, you see what I mean? Because they're a projection. Nobody went down and planted those trees in hell, and it's too hot for a normal tree to exist there, but they exist there,
What's the projection,
Pat Dobe Daksam, it's on your exam. Dobe Pat Daksam. Dobe. Excuse me?
What's the word in Sanskrit?
Oh, I don't know. It's something like... I forget. Kalpalata or something. Kalpa. It comes from the root kalpa. Kalpa. Okay. I think. Okay. Pretty sure. Okay. Before you catch me more. 25. This is a question about the three. We went up in class 9. We graduated to the independent group of the middle way school. Okay. Svatantrika, which has nothing to do with tantra. It's just a similar word, okay? Meaning independent school, because they think that certain kinds of reasons have an independent existence or something, that they're independently effective in arguing emptiness or something like that. Okay, so they believe in three degrees of selflessness, and only the third degree is true emptiness. Although the other two degrees can be described as the emptiness of blah, 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 okay? But they talk about three degrees of emptiness. And if you're on a lower track, you perceive first degree. If you're on a medium track, which is you know, self-made Buddha track, you perceive the second degree, and if you're on a Mahayana track, you perceive the third degree, which is emptiness. Okay, but this question is just a general question about those 3 degrees. What are the 3 degrees? Gross lack of a self nature to the person. Sorry, subtle is selflessness number, lack of self nature number one. The obvious or gross lack of a self nature to things is the second degree selflessness, and then true emptiness is the subtle lack of a nature to things. Okay, and you know that things here is a code word for parts of a person, as opposed to the person. Okay. That's pretty cool. It's easy to describe. I'm sorry, 26. It's easy to confuse the three tracks with the three different ways mentioned in scripture, especially since the Tibetan for both is the same. The Tibetan, by the way, is Tekpa Sum, right? The three tekpas, the three yanas. Okay, and it says describe the difference. So the three tracks, when you're talking about three flavors of selflessness, for example, are listener track, self-made Buddha track, and Bodhisattva track. Those are three tekpas, tekpa sum. How many of them are tekmen or hinayana? These two. And then Bodhisattva, the highest one is Mahayana. Okay. What's the other group of three tekpas or yanas? They call, this is a Dharma rumor, okay? Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. But really you should say what? Hinayana and Mahayana, and then inside of Mahayana you have open and secret Mahayana. Okay? This one called the way of the perfections, and this one called the way of the secret word. Okay? Or the way of the diamond. Those are synonyms. Okay, Mantrayana and Vajrayana are synonyms. Okay? So that's clear, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Very sleepy. Me too. Okay. I kind of like this because, you know, it finally dawned on me that Lord Buddha went from saying that, you know, here you got mind-only school is saying what percentage of this object comes from its own side according to the mind-only school? 100%. Rangunidupa. Okay? Rangitumamayamidulukingunidupa. Okay? It comes from its own side. Now, in the independent group, middle way school, what percentage, in a sense, of the object comes from its own side?
50%.
About 50%. Okay? There has to be something appearing, and my unaffected, undrugged, unhallucinating, unmentally afflicted, grossly mentally unafflicted mind has to somewhere in the middle they have to agree. Like the magician, the example of the magician. Okay? There has to be a stick there that's appearing as a horse, and then your mind, under the influence of the magic dust and magic words of the magician, has to be seeing it that way. And somewhere in the middle you start to see a horse. Okay? So there has to be something coming from its side, which is horse, and there has to be something coming from your side which sees horse. And then somewhere in the middle you get a horse. Okay? Now, what's the Prasangika presentation? There's nothing horse about it. Nothing. There is a cylinder. Okay? I mean, there's a cylinder. And then it's not, you could say it's suggesting pen, but there's no penness of it. Okay? It doesn't have any quality of penness of its own. It's all imposed on that cylinder by your perceptions forced upon you, or you are compelled to see it that way because of your past karma. Okay? And by the way, the important thing here is, if it had any existence from its own side, 100% like the mind-only school says, or 50% like the independent school says, then you and I are stuck here. We can't get enlightened. Forget it. Why? Because you won't be able to perceive your arm as Manjushri's arm. Okay? And you won't be able to perceive your mind as an enlightened mind. You're stuck with the way your mind is known. If it comes, if 2% of it, if 1% of it, Nagarjuna would say, if 1,000th of 1% of it comes from its own side, you're in trouble. You can't become a Buddha. You know. But the Prasangika viewpoint is that, okay, because it's Tope Partaktam, you can become a Buddha.
Unless you posit that the whole Buddha nature is self-sufficient, originally you
like
yeah, that. Yeah, unless you had some wrong idea about Buddha nature. Yeah. Well, even then, if that Buddha nature existed from its own side, you'd still be in trouble because the thing covering it would exist from its own side. You see? And then it could never be removed. It could never be changed. By the way, if it were changed by externally self-existing causes, then you could do it. You see what I mean? You got to get used to that. Start thinking of things as being created this way and not as being created this way. You see what I mean? In kids' class, we call it the difference between the how and the why. Okay, on Saturday we say, did you have any friends that had something bad happen today? So yeah, my friend was run over by a car. Sammy's friend was run over by a car and killed. Okay, and we say, how did it happen? He says, well, he got hit by the car. Then we say, why did it happen? We say, he must have hurt somebody in the past. And you just, you know, the kids get it right away. I don't know about the adults, but the distinction between how and why. You see, how is describing the circumstances that seem to be causing the thing. How did the guy die? His head went through the windshield. Why did the guy die? He hurt someone in his past life. The how is just the expression of the why. And you got to get used to that. Okay? Otherwise, you're stuck here. You know, you can't protect everybody's head from windshields. If that's what really kills people, we're in trouble. You know, what really kills them is their karma. Okay. Yeah.
Where does the cylinder come from?
Bill said, where does the cylinder come from? This is called the onion skin theory, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, Nagarjuna says, until such time as you begin to discuss the cylinder, you want to talk pen or you want to talk cylinder? Are we going to examine the existence of the pen or are we going to examine the existence of the cylinder? When you're examining the existence of the pen, you talk about a cylinder as if it were there from its own side. You leave it, okay, as if it were a priori, as if it were there from the beginning. And then you talk about your projections onto it as being a pen or as being a chewable thing. And then some smart aleck comes along and says, what about the cylinder? Okay. Okay. What about the cylinder? Now, and then you say, same principle applies. There's two parts. And your mind is synthesizing them into a cylinder. Okay? And then they say, well, what about the, you know, and then it goes on and on and on and on. And that's called, tanitapitatansauitsenamanye means, that's what it means in the Madhyamika system to not exist by definition. That's why we say it doesn't exist by definition. Because if you keep going down, it's endless. You'll never find anything. Okay? One more thing. Does that mean that we are to be, by the way, Bodhisattva vow number, I don't remember, okay? But don't teach emptiness to the unprepared. Meaning, never leave the discussion at that point. Never let Jehan interrupt you at that moment with a new question. Always point out to the audience, it doesn't mean that you have to be disoriented. It doesn't mean that you can't get onto a bus because you're going to fall to the earth or something like that, okay? Never think that. There is a reality to everything. If you don't think so, let me mark up your face with this cylinder. You know, we'll make a Hitler mustache or something, or, you know what I mean, like that. On a projected level, it's there. And it hurts you or it makes you feel good and it has reality. Total reality. You always have to say that. And that's determined by your goodness. By how well you keep your vows. How well you check yourself. Tundu, please. Not twice a day, not once a day. Okay? Tundu. Okay? Okay? And you have to add that. Then you can say to Jehan, okay, now we'll go on. Okay. Yeah.
You never define distinction here.
Yeah. Oh, Lake Wateri Chungkor.
Let's talk about experience of time now.
Okay.
Yeah,
there's a big debate about time. He's asking about time. Abhidharma has a beautiful debate about time in it. You know, all these different viewpoints about time. It's a one viewpoint about time that says, you know, really the past is coming at you and the future's leaving you behind. And, you know, yeah, in this school, time is also a projection. In the Prasangika school, yeah. Time is also a projection, yeah. Because it's a thing. Because it exists. Sure. It's a changing thing. Time itself? Yeah, they'd say it's a changing thing. Yeah.
Time isn't a concept?
Huh?
Isn't a concept?
I think you could say it's a concept, yeah. And therefore it's a changing thing. In Prasangika. crossing people. Yeah, why not? Why not? An idea. Sure, all concepts change in crossing people. Demanduchi, that's the meaning of Demanduchi. Sukshepa dhanda chalayana duje dhanduma chanyi. All things divide into changing things and unchanging things. Duje layana sukshepa dhamanduchi sum. And if you divide changing things... Huh? No. The concept of empty space changes. Empty space doesn't change. Quote, empty space changes. Empty space doesn't change. How's that? Huh? How can you talk about the flow of time independent? How can you talk about time independent and flow of time? You just plunked down the Abhidharma. You know, partless moment of time. By the way, when they speak of partless, sometimes they extend it to time. They say partless means their idea of ultimate reality is something which cannot be divided even in the mind. Physically, nor time, spatially or temporally. And that's ultimate reality. You know, they believe in, not only in partless atoms, but they believe in indivisible moments of time. Okay? Independent of the flow of time. Okay. All right. The last three questions four questions are just good luck questions, okay? It's to finish the 7-year course on a sacred note, okay? These are the four ideas that I would want any student that said they ever attended a Michael Roach course or an ACI course would say, without doubt, without hesitation, they would give the right answer to these four, okay? To me, they are the essence of emptiness or Buddhist philosophy. 28, when we say that things are only projection, does that mean we can make up anything into what we want it to be? No. Why or why not? They are forced upon you by your karma. Okay? Can you just decide this is a $100 bill? I don't know. Try. That's the essence of, and I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying I grew up with this. That's the essence of the concept of Christian prayer. Okay? I mean, it's one of the fallacies of one part of one concept of Christian prayer that by wishing something it will happen.
You say,
the only way to make this into a $100 bill is to give away something. Yeah. Yeah, no, but I mean not by immediately wishing. Let's say that. Okay, I'll qualify it by saying, just by closing my eyes and saying, oh God, please make this a $100 bill. You discovered the consequences of that when you were about 6. You know? And then you lost your belief in religion and thought that religion couldn't work anymore and that there was no heaven. That was a fallacy too. There is a heaven, you can get there, because those things don't work by wish. You see what I mean? Because they can only work by good karma. Okay, you have to be generous. You have to practice the 6 perfections. You have to keep your vows and check them once a day, twice a day, or tundur. Okay? You have to do that. Okay? That's the only way to get this to turn into a $100 bill. But not just by wishing it. Saying it's a projection is not meant to imply that you can just make it anything you want. Okay, you're at the mercy of your projections, of your karma, of whatever seeds you've planted there. You must reap the results, unless you do a really good purification or something. Okay, or a really good rejoicing, or something like that. Okay, does the fact that... Oh, by the way, the question before that said, was the middle way school... Oh, yeah, you know that. Okay, 29. Does the fact that things are only projections mean that leading an ethical way of life is unimportant? No, I mean, you see, when we started the 7 years, you would not have giggled in the right place. Okay? You would have said, You know what I mean? I mean, that's a big compliment. I take it as a big compliment. You know, if you start laughing when a teacher gets up and says, because everything is emptiness, you can engage in any kind of monkey business you want, if you start laughing there, you should laugh those guys out of the country. Okay? Go back. Okay, you're wearing some nice clothes, but go back. Don't say that to me. That's a very bad viewpoint. Okay? That's a ridiculous viewpoint. Because things are empty, I must keep my vows. Okay? Because things are empty, I must practice the most powerful practices I can. Because things are empty. Okay? I must keep my vows. All right? Okay, 30. Why does the consequence meaning prasangika, right? Presentation of the meaning of emptiness have especially important implications in our own search for enlightenment. I mean, that's the only way to get enlightened, okay? If things were not empty, we'd be in trouble. If things were not being created by your projections, forced on you by your sweet, virtuous behavior of the past, then you'd be in trouble. You could never become a Buddha. And it, you know, it's easy to talk about it with physical things and events in your life, but don't forget, it also applies to the state of your mind. Whether or not you ever wake up and get to view your own mind as being totally pure also is a projection. Arhats, people who've just reached nirvana, are projecting a mind state which is pure and has no more mental afflictions. You see? Their virtue is forcing on them an experience of their own thoughts which is totally pure. You see? That's also a projection. To wake up one morning and not hear a single negative thought in your mind for the whole morning, which is called nirvana. No, that's the definition of nirvana, right? To hear that, to hear your mind be that way, is also a projection. And you can only get there by keeping your vows. Okay? But don't ever check them more than once or twice a day. Okay. And don't keep that book. It's a real hassle. Okay? It takes a whole 30 seconds, I think, or 45 seconds, you know. Okay. Don't have time for that. 31. Last question. Last thing in the class. Okay. This is like when you finish your geshe. Some of you guys know that when you finish your geshe, you know, 7 days of very painful examinations, you know, and the last question they come up and you say, you know, the guy says, it's impossible for all sentient, you know, is what is it? Sentient Tantra Sanjaya Yata, meaning, oh, are you telling me it's possible for everybody to get enlightened, you know, to turn into a Buddha, and they go, bah! You know, and then everybody screams and throws their hats up in the air. It's really cool. It's like graduating from West Point or something like that. Okay, anyway. Now, people scream, you know, when they just made a geshe, because you can hear it all through the monastery. Even, you know, I think there's even some Sarah J. geshes. And you hear this noise, you hear this screaming from about, you know, half a mile away, you can hear the screaming, and you say, oh great, somebody just finished, you know. It's very cool. Okay, anyway. The Heart Sutra says that the real goal of Buddhism is to, quote, stop the process of aging and death through, quote, stopping our ignorance. Maripa sepa mepa ne gashi me, gashi sepe pali yamedo. Okay? Is this a literal or a figurative statement?
Literal.
We'll stop there. Okay.
11. You have been listening to What the Buddha Really Meant with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009. Or call 212-475-7752.